From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's hard to believe, but this is our last show of the year, and what a year it's been. As we head into 2020, we're sharing a few of our favorite segments from the past year. First up is a story about Salvadoran food that first aired in August. It takes place here in LA, which is home to the largest ethnic Salvadoran population outside of El Salvador. One LA food writer has been on a mission to preserve Salvi recipes in the U.S. Contributor Audrey No profiled her for Good Food.
It's a brisk Saturday morning in Silver Lake, and Carla Vasquez is speaking to an audience of nine, all seated at a shady backyard table. She's hosting her third Salvadoran cooking workshop. Today, it's all about quesadilla, a sweet and savory cheesy bread, often topped with sesame seeds.
The recipe requires a hard cheese, an aged cheese. Most of the ingredients that are used in El Salvador are Salvadoran cheeses.
One of which is queso duro blando, a hard, salty cheese. It's a popular ingredient in El Salvador, though importing it to the U.S. can be costly. But Carla says even if you don't live in El Salvador, you can substitute ingredients here in LA, and that doesn't make this food any less Salvadoran.
Folks use, you know, an aged cheese that is affordable to them, and it doesn't stop being true Salvadoran quesadilla.
Authenticity is a major theme in Carla's workshops, where most of the attendees grew up with Salvi moms and grandmothers in the kitchen. Jennifer Corletto says she's here to learn food traditions for her family.
When I was younger, I didn't really pay attention in the kitchen so much, and I had lost my mom when I was 15, so I didn't really get that opportunity as an adult to be like, okay, mom, now show me what to do. So I'm learning this so I can pass it off to my kids, because I'm a first generation here, and I wouldn't want that to just end with me.
As you can hear from Jennifer's voice, this is more than a cooking class. It's about being able to give a part of herself to her children through food. And sharing recipes is something that can get lost when moms have too much on their plate. Carla explains.
The kitchens are efficient spaces, so it's not a time to be very romantic about, oh, we're learning and this is a mother-daughter beautiful exchange. No, a lot of our grandmothers and mothers were too busy surviving.
Speaking of grandmothers, Carla's abuelita, Mama Lucy, was a big part of why she's so passionate about sharing Salvadoran food culture. Several years ago, Carla asked Mama Lucy if she could document her recipes.
And she was like, I love this. Of course you can do it. And she says, esto se trata de legado. What you're doing is about legacy.
That conversation led to Carla's cookbook, Salvi Sol. The book, which Carla is still shopping around to agents, will feature foods like rellenos de pecaya, a cheese-stuffed edible flower bud, and torrejas, a syrupy treat with thick slices of cake or milk bread accompanied by chelate, a hot corn-based drink. Twenty-five LA women who emigrated from El Salvador contributed recipes to the project. But the soul in Salvi Sol is most apparent in their various personal stories, which Carla documented to go along with each woman's respective dish in the book. Tahunga resident Estela Alfaro is one of the women profiled in Salvi Sol. She came to the U.S. in 1985 because of the Salvadoran Civil War. For the book, Estela talked about her abuelita and the food they used to share back in their hometown of Canton La Labor. Estela says her grandma was a force in the kitchen.
I have clear memories of her harvesting the corn, cooking it, then grinding it by hand.
One of Estela's featured recipes in Salvi Sol is mamaso. It's a handmade corn tortilla, hot from the griddle, blended with fresh cheese.
And so you blend it while it's hot so that it kind of like the cheese infuses into the tortilla, and then you make it into a little ball, and then you eat that.
Estela's whole face lights up when she talks about mamaso, and that has a lot to do with her abuelita, who raised Estela in El Salvador for several years while her mother built a life for them here in the U.S. Estela says being able to enjoy freshly made mamaso after school was about stability.
Coming home to that it just gave me the love and the reassurance that I had someone that really cared for me there.
Estela isn't alone. Carla says there was a lot of excitement when she mentioned Mamaso to the other women featured in the book.
And as soon as I'd say Mamaso, they're like, oh, Mamasos, wow, my abuelita used to make that. I'd come home from school and I'd be so hungry and there would be some Mamasos there. And so I quickly got the impression that this was a very tender moment kind of food culture.
Estela had to rely a lot on childhood memories to piece together her own mamaso recipe. And even though it might not be exactly the same as her abuelita's, Estela says she still goes to great lengths to replicate the ingredients she first tasted in El Salvador.
You gotta place your hands on the milk and just start like slowly forming the cheese ball. Being able to do that just from memory, I think that's really special.
Carla has seen Estela go through this cheese-making process firsthand. She says that attention to detail is authentically Salvi.
It didn't matter that it was milk from the Rouse. It might as well have been my grandmother's kitchen. And that felt like it was authentic.
As Carla talks more about Salvi Sol, you can hear how much preserving these recipes and stories means to her.
This is the blood of this work. It's the legacy of the Salvadoran mom and what she's done for her children and what she's done for her family.
Back in Silver Lake, the workshop attendees blend ingredients together for three different kinds of quesadilla. One made with Parmesan, one with queso duro blando, and one with sour cream. When the final result is presented, everyone digs in. And even though it's a backyard in Silver Lake, one thing is clear. This is the taste of El Salvador. For Good Food, I'm Audrey Ngo.
My thanks to contributor Audrey Ngo, who reported on Salvi Sol in August. To learn more about Carla Vasquez, her book, and her workshops, visit salvisol.com and check out the photos and more information on the Good Food website. Visit kcrw.com/goodfood. This story was made possible by the Independent Producer Project. After the break, we're revisiting a great segment on the psychology of restaurant menus. Stick around for more of our Best of Good Food show.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and we're revisiting some of our favorite segments of the year.
Now, the more I studied restaurant design, the more I realized the important connection, inseparable relationship between restaurant design and restaurant business and operations. And the menu clearly became a central focus.
That's art historian Allison Perlman. I spoke with her in May about her research into restaurant menus around Los Angeles. She wanted to find out how they influence what we order. Her book is called May We Suggest.
I love this subject so much.
I'm thrilled. There's not much that a restaurant does that a menu doesn't impact.
And it's really fascinating because a lot of independent restaurant owners don't often think about the menu as a sales tool.
So true. I found a tremendous range of reactions when I talked to chefs, when I talked to restaurateurs for the book. I found everything from just completely ignoring this fact completely to an extremely savvy understanding of everything, of language, of image, of where to put the prices on the menu, the layout, everything, texture, materials. But what's interesting about that is, in spite of the fact that there's so much range in knowledge and an interest in using the menu as a merchandising tool, there's a lot of imitation, just because people who don't know are still imitating a lot of the tactics that the people who do know do. For example, staggering prices on a list. I have not seen anything on a list of items on a menu that went from lowest price to highest price on a list. That was never the order that I saw. Somehow by imitation, there's this sense that you just don't do that, and I never saw it.
That's so interesting. Now I'm wondering if I used to do that.
Did you?
I don't know. I mean, that's fascinating. How did you conceive of this project? And how long did you gather your materials by talking to chefs and restaurateurs?
Yeah, well, this is a long time, this whole project getting shaped. I mean, starting from the very early days of, I started collecting menus when I was a teenager. I've always loved menus. And it's because I love restaurants. In the beginning, I just wanted to hold on to the memories. And it was about souvenir having. And then, you know, I became an art historian. I started to realize, because art historians study how visual and material artifacts shape our social lives, I realized my love of restaurants, which preceded being an art historian, I realized from that discipline of being an art historian that restaurant design was, you know, a socially revealing object of analysis, not just a personal passion. So I went full steam ahead and decided 12 years ago, I committed myself to studying this. Now, the more I studied restaurant design, the more I realized the important connection, inseparable relationship between restaurant design and restaurant business and operations. And the menu clearly became a central focus.
One of the things that fascinates me when I think about this is, on one end, you have the chain restaurant or often deli menus that are physically large, laminated, very easy to read, unless there's too much on them, bold fonts. And then at the other end, the more effete, perhaps, and you'll have a single page, often with a screened back font that makes it difficult for people of a certain age to read it, in which there's almost no description. Like, the litany of ingredients separated by commas now seems to be the description of choice. What was your range in the chefs and the restaurants that you decided to explore?
One of the really important things in me deciding which restaurants to go to, the entire list of 60 restaurant brands that I visited, 77 visits to 60 restaurant brands, had to span 40 restaurant characteristics that preliminary research that I did determined shaped menu design. So everything from what kind of service style, whether it was formal, casual, whether it was full service, half service, self-service, whether it was geared towards children, whether it was a vanguard menu or a traditionalist menu, what kind of food, everything. There was everything in between. I came up with a list of 40 characteristics. And I made sure that those 60 restaurant brands that I went to spanned all 40 of those characteristics. So I really tried to encompass in my range everything I could possibly think of, plus making sure that I found the most outlandish formats that I could possibly find, because I wanted to encompass as many possibilities and many styles of menus as I could. For example, I made sure to go to a spoken menu, a completely spoken menu. So it was just about the speech. I made sure to...
Where was that?
This
Gardens
was
of Tosca?
Gardens of Tosca, which is, of course, now not doing that anymore.
I know. We did, gosh, 15 years ago.
Yes.
We actually recorded one of the servers giving that speech.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And so spoken menus had to be part of it. I wanted to go also to places that had entertainments to see how the menu meshed with the whole concept of an entertainment, belly dancing. I went to Moon of Tunis, of course. I had to see how the menu was integrated into the whole scenario that involved performance, where the menu fit in the script.
how many items were on the biggest menu and how many items on the smallest menu?
So we're talking probably for the biggest over 260.
Where was
items.
That?
And I believe J&K Hong Kong Cuisine, which is now no longer, there's so many disappearances. It's actually quite another story, another topic. And of course, actually, Jit La Da was
close.
And that's famously close, right?
Yeah.
Famously long. But for smallest, there was a place in Koreatown that serves only boiled beef and bone broth soup, and that is the Hanbat Sulongtang restaurant. And that I had to make sure that that was in the mix because I also wanted to talk about how much is enough choice on a menu. What is enough?
What is enough?
That's a chapter. It's a chapter. But what it is that I realized is that it matters how much. It matters how much there is, and it matters what range there is. So the scope and the size matter, but what it should be is very complicated.
Let's talk a bit about the visual look of a menu and where items are placed visually, because that's the other thing that fascinates me between sort of high-end, more considered restaurants these days, which tend to be just a list typed, as opposed to other kinds of restaurants where there's all kinds of stuff going on. There's boxes and there's different colors maybe.
Right, right. In fact, Applebee's was one of the places I went to and found when I went probably the most elaborate example of hierarchy in terms of visuals. An elaborate scheme of not only pictures in different sizes, in different layouts, but also all manner of typographic symbols, colors, emphasis on certain things through ribbons and symbols of little apples to point out what's healthful on the menu. Such an elaborate hierarchy of symbolism that indicated priorities. This also reflects very much the way that that restaurant operates, that there are priorities that they are trying to sell at any given time.
It's very sophisticated.
Extremely. And they do it every quarter. It's a huge operation because it gets redone very consistently.
I've noticed after going to high-end degustation menus recently that often you're not given a menu until the very end. And
right.
Then, like you say, your souvenir gathering, it's given to you as a souvenir.
Right. Yeah, this is menu as theater program, you know, right?
Instead, but even when you get a theater program, you get it when you
beforehand.
Walk in.
Right, that's true, beforehand. Exactly, it is a souvenir. And often in that way, the art form of it, right? A memory, that thing is still operating, however, as a sales tool even then. Because even as a memory, as something that you want to take and maybe share with other people, show to other people, remember, want to come back. And there's such poetry that goes into these menus, right? They're poetry. I thought of these menus very often as a kind of a literary genre unto themselves.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, they are.
So who do you think has menu designed down to a science?
The menu I was most impressed with, I have to say, the one that really sticks with me as sort of a genius menu design is 800 Degrees, or the 800 Degrees when I went to visit it. This is a menu style that in the book I call the assembly line menu. It is not only a menu that sells you food, it is also a menu that designs your experience of waiting for the food. Simultaneously, they're interwoven. So you walk down a line, a literal physical line, like a cafeteria, and you're building a pizza along this line. And as you go down the line, there's a brilliant sense of timing. One interaction across to the server on the other side of the counter brings a choice about pizza dough, pizza toppings, pizza, all of these things,
we
salads.
We would call this the chipotleization.
Exactly. Customization all the way down the line. By the time you are done, at the end of the line, your pizza is ready out of that oven. There's an ingeniousness to the structure of that line so that it is about designing an experience of waiting for food that gives you the illusion that you haven't waited that much.
In all of your research, and I know this probably is an unfortunate question, but was there a menu that just hit the spot for you? you personally, who you are as an eater, where after you had sensitized yourself to all of these issues, you got a menu and you said, yes.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I am a sucker for those, you know, enigmatic, poetic, brief comma menus. I'm sorry, it's terrible, but I'm a sucker for those. So also no longer Ink restaurant. They were poetic because the juxtaposition of unexpected ingredients in this line of poetry and the suggestiveness of that and not knowing the mysteriousness of it is, of course, exactly what you go there for, because it's a very vanguard restaurant. You want to be surprised. It sets up surprise. That's it doing its job exactly as it should be.
Such a fascinating book. We could talk for so long. Thank you so much, Alison Perlman.
It's my pleasure.
That's LA-based art historian and cultural critic Alison Perlman. We spoke in May about the psychology of restaurant menus. Her book is called May We Suggest? Restaurant Menus and the Art of Persuasion.
I like the way that you can have a physical border, but things are going to get through anyway. And food will always travel, and people will always travel, and ideas especially.
That's author Caroline Eden. In May, I spoke with her about her travels around the Black Sea. Over 1,400 miles, she explored flavors and ingredients that are the product of centuries of migration and trade winds. The result was one of my favorite books of the year. It's called Black Sea, Dispatches and Recipes Through Darkness and Light. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Evan.
That subtitle just says so much. You say that the Black Sea is overflowing with intrigue. It often feels as though it's the pivot of the geopolitical world.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I have an essay in the book which I think sums that up, and it's called Bosphorus Blues. And it's all about how you can sit on the Bosphorus in Istanbul and see Putin's warships coming through the center of the city. And when you sit there and you watch the Bosphorus and you see cargo ships loaded with Georgian tomatoes and military ships, and it's a bit like turning the pages of the newspaper. And it's, you know, the border of the Christian and the Islamic world. It's where Europe ends, which for us at the moment is obviously a very important time in our history. And yeah, I think it is the center of the geopolitical world. It's a very, and it has been for a very long time. It's not new.
You're coming off the heels of your book, Samarkand, where it's all about Central Asia, which is equally intriguing and relatively unknown for a lot of us. But this feels even more so. What was it that made you start to ruminate about it enough to realize that you wanted to spend time writing about it? And then what part of it? Because it's pretty large.
I've been visiting Istanbul for many years, and it's a city I absolutely love. And it's at the center of this book. And obviously, Turkey's got a lot of Silk Road history, much like Central Asia. So it's always been on my radar, the Black Sea. And I've read quite a lot of historical books about it. And I did a very long road trip back in 2013 from London to Tbilisi. And we traveled this route. And I started to read up on it more. And I just thought, how interesting to look at this historic region through its food ways and through its food cultures, and to try and sort of reveal a modern portrait of this place, which feels quite frontier, a bit like Central Asia, you know, quite a sort of unknown place, a mysteriousness to it, sort of set apart. And I didn't want to circumnavigate the whole thing. For me, that felt like a token thing to do. I wanted to bookend it by two cities, Odessa in southern Ukraine, Catherine the Great's port city, relatively new, 1794, and finish in Trabzon, which is a city which has really fallen out of people's minds in the West, but was an incredibly important city in northern Turkey, which is a very much a Black Sea city. And then sort of neatly in the middle, Istanbul, which is not on the Black Sea, but is connected neatly by the Bosphorus. So that was my idea, sort of book of three cities and then stopping at different points between.
You talk about how some of these borders that are on the water, near the water, are more permeable from a cultural standpoint.
The borders are there, but there's something that links the countries, which a physical land border can't stop. So I think we in Britain at the moment are obsessed with borders and what it means to be part of things. And I think I can't help but have that in my subconscious when I travel at the moment. And I like the way that you can have a physical border, but things are going to get through anyway. The Black Sea's always been a great place of huge migration. The Tatars fled. A lot of people from the North Caucasus fled. Most of these groups ended up in Turkey. Turkey has been a great harbour for many people who've fled, Muslims who've fled persecution over the years. And they've retained their culture in Istanbul. Istanbul is such a Black Sea city. Yeah, it's interesting. You have the fixed borders, but then I think if you meet someone in Turkey who lives right on the Black Sea and you meet someone in Bulgaria who lives right on the Black Sea, they're going to have things in common. The sea joins people and it divides people. It's a real conundrum.
So let's start, as you do in the book, with Odessa in southern Ukraine, which shares a Jewish and an Italian identity. My parents left for America from Odessa at the beginning of the 20th century. And it still retains a lot of that Jewish identity. While you were there, one of your primary food experiences was the one you describe as happening pretty soon after you arrive, the local platter, I think you called it.
Yes, I'd sort of been expecting it. I'd heard about the sort of foods that you find in Odessa, which are traditional foods. So I sort of sat in the hotel and it was late and I said, what do you have? And I expected a sort of smorgasbord of maybe some smoked cheeses and cold meats and things. And what came was quintessentially Odessan to the table. And it was forshmak, so it was the herring pate, which is actually rather nice. It looks a bit grey, but it's sort of herring, sour cream, apples, all sort of food processed and put on some crackers. Slightly more alarming, gobies, which are a kind of ball-headed, bony fish. Got through those okay. And then rapani, which was the biggest challenge of the trio. And rapani are sea snails. And what they do is they take the snail and they sort of cook it up with cream and herbs, and then it's sort of put back in the shell and you eat it cold. And it's sort of got the texture of mushrooms. It's not wholly unpleasant, but quite different to anything I'd had before. And I think I say in the book that what it needs is to be accompanied by strong drinks.
And your waiter said something quite pithy to you.
Yes, I think she said something like, the rapani arrive stuck on the hulls of trade ships to eat our mussels, so we eat them. It was something along those lines, I think.
So perfect.
Yeah.
So between Odessa and Istanbul is Bulgaria. Tell me about Elena.
Elena was quite a remarkable woman. She was a surprise in many ways. We had traveled, I wanted to see a traditional small fishing village in Bulgaria. Our fixer, I had a Bulgarian helping me there. I didn't have them all the way along the trip, but I needed somebody in Bulgaria. And he said, I'll take you to this tiny fishing village. So we went and we met a woman there called Elena. And she was working in a small cafe and she sat with us and we had a beer sort of mid-afternoon. And we were surrounded by sort of slightly salty male fishermen. And she said, I'm the last fisherwoman of Bulgaria. So I said, okay, this sounds interesting. Tell me more. And she just said that she'd grown up in a family of fishermen and it was an incredibly dangerous life. And these fishermen that I met around the Black Sea, I guess it's the same for fishermen the world over, they get very emotional when they talk about the sea. And her eyes were very intense and she was making lots of hand moves about pulling the rope through her hands and sort of storms she'd encountered. And she broke all the rules. She'd go out and fish on her own at night and she'd stay out there sometimes. She'd take a cooking stove out. And there are not many safe harbours around that part of the coast, so it really is quite dangerous. And she'd had a lot of near misses. And then towards the end of the chat, Elena, I could feel the sort of interview running away slightly and something going off course. And very tragically, she told me that she'd lost her daughter just a few weeks ago. And now that she goes out to fish on her own and it's the only place that gives her solace. It's sort of a place she goes to grieve out there on the waves by herself. And that was a very intense, difficult conversation, but she was wonderful. She gave me a hug at the end and she said, you know, they're making a documentary about me. I mean, I had no reason to believe that she was the last fisherwoman of Bulgaria. She said that no other women are doing this now. It's too dangerous, the money's not enough. But she had a connection with the Black Sea that kept taking her out there to deal with life's difficult times. So, yeah, that was a real insight.
Now, Istanbul, with both European and Asian sides, doesn't sit per se on the Black Sea, but obviously is influenced by it. How does the sea itself come to be representative in the city's food and culture?
I found Istanbul to be a very Black Sea city. Strange things. I mean, it's a huge city, Istanbul. So I guess when you start looking for something, things are going to show up. But taxi drivers seem to all be from Rize in a particular part of Istanbul I was from. And that's where they do the tea harvests up on the Black Sea coast. I met musicians from the Black Sea. There are restaurants dedicated to Black Sea food, some of them quite trendy in the sort of best areas of Istanbul. And the food, I mean, hamsi, which are the Black Sea anchovies, Turks are wild about hamsi. When it's hamsi season, it's sort of greatly anticipated. It's in the winter months, which is when they sort of shoal down towards this part of Turkey and they're caught. And they go into rice dishes and they're fried and they go into sort of little crackers and they're really super delicious. So food-wise, it's all there, but it's also the people as well. So a lot of white Russians fleeing the Bolsheviks came to Istanbul in the 1920s, and there are still some white Russian restaurants, just a handful left in Istanbul, selling Russian food. I go to a couple of those and talk about that. Some Russian churches still exist. There are many people from the North Caucasus who fled persecution, Circassians, people from North Ossetia. They've kept their recipes very closely guarded and served them in Istanbul. It was everywhere. The more I started to look into it, the more I found Black Sea influences in Istanbul.
Though you're focused in travel, you are really incredibly adept at capturing culture through the lens of food. Do you have an idea where you're planning to go next, or are you going to be taking a long break now?
I'm having some time out at the moment, doing some traveling here in Scotland, up in the Highlands. Yes, I'm having a bit of a break for now, but I love it. I think that there's almost, you can tell any story through food. I think food's a great agent for telling stories and meeting people and talking about people's lives. Obviously, the human stories that I find most interesting and the history. So serve me well, I hope, for Black Sea. It was such a pleasure to write the book.
Well, it's really extraordinary. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
That's travel writer and journalist Caroline Eden. We spoke in May about her travels around the Black Sea, which inspired a book by the same name. After the break, we take a look at a great segment we did on how we can get creative with food scraps. More of Good Food's best segments when we return. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, and we've been listening to some of our favorite segments from the past year. So it's a peanut ricotta?
It's similar to that, yes. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you're infusing the milk?
Yes.
So you could also make a peanut ice cream?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
In January, I spoke with writer Lindsay Jean Hard about turning peanut shells into cheese. I'm not kidding. It's one of the recipes in her book titled Cooking with Scraps. On average, an American produces about 133 pounds of food waste each year, while 40% of food in this country goes uneaten. In response, the USDA has set a nationwide goal to cut food waste in half by the year 2030. Lindsay Jean Hard suggests doing your part by cooking with things like peels, cores, rinds, and stems. Personally, I just eat them. Hi, Lindsay Jean.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great. I have to say that there have been quite a few books out in the last few years about food waste and scraps, but I think what I admire most about yours is that it's really a manual. It's a tool so that as you come upon different situations, you can go to it and try and find a solution.
Yeah, I really hope that people see it as a reference guide. I tried to organize it from A to Z, so it's something that you can turn to when you don't know what to do with a specific ingredient.
What's interesting, too, is you credit so many different people throughout the book with ideas that it seems like for you, adopting new strategies has just become the norm.
Yeah, the whole thing was really a learning process for me. It came out of a column that I had when I was working at food52.com, a food and lifestyle website. And I had a column of the same name, Cooking with Scraps, and I would hunt through the community archives of recipes looking for ones where people were making smart use of underutilized produce parts. And I just learned so much from them in the process that I wanted to share that and, of course, credit the people that I learned from along the way.
So you lived in Japan for a time where you were introduced to the concepts of motenai and harahachibu. Could you explain their meaning and why they resonated for you?
Yeah, so harahachibu is a traditional Okinawan saying, and it's one that listeners are probably familiar with. It's eat until you're 80% full. That's pretty easy when we think about it, but then in practice, that can be a little bit harder.
Deliciousness sometimes gets in the way.
Yes. So I just try and think of it as eating slowly and eating to the point where I'm comfortable and just giving my brain time to catch up with my stomach. And then the other one, motenai, is somewhat similar to the English expression of waste not, want not. But the Japanese expression, for me, somehow manages to capture the gratefulness for what a gift it was in the first place, whether it's food or time or something else entirely. So you're really appreciating what it was.
So I want to start, well, first of all, I should probably say all my life I've kind of been known as a garbage eater. I've always eaten apple cores.
Yeah.
And also, there are several kinds of citrus peels I really love, particularly with some tangerines and some oranges, where I just eat them like apples.
I eat the whole thing, too.
But I want to start with broccoli and cauliflower, because as a restaurateur, if you look at a head of broccoli, if what you're going to do is just cut off those stems and serve the crowns, there is just so much waste.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of waste, which is why I think that chefs are doing a better job of this than the general public, because they recognize that it impacts the bottom line of their restaurant. And we need to realize that it impacts the bottom line of our households, too.
So let's talk about what you can do with broccoli stems and also the parts of cauliflower that people tend to discard, the core stem piece at the bottom, mm-hmm. and then the leaves that are attached. I always wish there were more leaves.
I know, I do too, and there are on the plant. We're seeing more broccoli stems come into the market now, so I think we need to continue this push so that we get the whole cauliflower plant coming to the store with the leaves on it too. The broccoli stems, I like to saute them. I like to poach them in olive oil and put them on toast, slice them up for slaw. I mean, they're so versatile.
Leek tops. Here, you know, so many of us shop at the farmers markets. And if you buy leeks in the farmers markets, you get extra super long tops.
Yeah.
What can we do with them?
That's another great example of one of the things that I think we've just been conditioned to get rid of, because the recipe tells you to use the white part and cut off and discard the green tops. But there's really no reason to do that. They're perfectly edible. So I like to chop them up finely, sliver them, and use them in pasta. But you could saute them and add them in with other mixed greens or use them as a topping on pizza. They're delicious.
One of the things I love about what you do with them when you're slivering them lengthwise is you're combining them into a cacio e pepe.
Yeah, so it really just mixes in with the noodles and adds color and flavor and doesn't waste the food.
I think one of the, well, there's a couple really surprising uses in the book, but banana peels.
I think that's probably the most surprising, yes. I like to cook them a little bit to soften them and then blend them into a puree. And I'm using them in the book in a cake. It gives it a really nice, light, bouncy texture. You would have no idea that it's made with banana peels. But you could use it other places in baking, too. Like, if you have a favorite banana bread recipe, you could sub in the banana peel puree instead of the mashed bananas.
At what point in the banana's ripeness are you using the peel in this way?
Ideally with super ripe bananas.
And you have a footnote that's so interesting about a link between something in the peel and latex.
Yeah, if you have a latex allergy, there's something in the banana peel that could trigger a similar reaction. So you should not eat them.
So interesting.
Yeah.
And this is a family recipe of yours.
Yeah, I originally did want to do a banana bread type recipe for the cookbook, but it's hard to find a perfect banana bread. I haven't found mine yet, but I do have this banana cake that I make every year for my birthday. That was my grandmother's recipe, and so I knew that was perfection, and so it was a good place to start.
Okay, so I understand using pineapple cores in things, because that's another thing where I always think of, why do we cut them out? It's just, I don't understand.
Unless I like to eat them.
Unless you don't have teeth, yeah. And also, I love to pickle them.
I haven't tried pickling them. That's a great idea.
They have the perfect texture for a snappy pickle.
Yeah.
But melon rinds, I have never ventured that far.
Well, I've had a lot of pickled melon rinds before, but I was trying to come up with something else different to do with it. The watermelon granita is one of my favorite recipes in the book. It's just so refreshing, and granitas are so easy.
Describe what part of the rind you're using.
So you're not using the dark green part of the watermelon peel. You're using the white part. And then if you have some of the extra fruit, the actual flesh, that's fine too. And it'll give it a little color.
So you actually make the granita just using the rind?
Yeah, when I had people testing the recipes, that mine was a clearish green because I stuck to just purely the white. But then I had testers who used slight bits of the fruit. So some were pink, some were yellow. Like, it's fun to see the different color ranges that you can get with it.
One of the section of the book that shows up throughout is a section on cleaning out the crisper.
Yes.
That's the saddest day. Untapped potential that we've let slip through our fingers.
Yeah, so we're trying to help avoid that happening. So when you have all of those odds and ends, these are the recipes that can help you put them to good use, whether it's a quick pickle or something like a frittata or a strata. So it's not necessarily using the underutilized produce parts in this case, though it could be. This is more of helping you with those other odds and ends that are hanging out in the fridge.
Oh, I have to ask you about the peanut shells, because peanut shells are something that I always think, why isn't there peanut shell mulch, you know, in the garden store? What are they doing with those peanut shells industrially?
Yeah. That's true. That one came out of chatting over drinks with friends, and we were trying to come up with the hardest to use scraps. Someone said coffee grounds, and then I came up with a couple recipes for that, and then someone said peanut shells, and I was like, that's such an interesting one. And it was fun to play around with because they do impart a lot of peanut flavor. I'm using them to make a simple pot cheese like ricotta, and it's incredibly salty.
That's so interesting. And then you just glossed over something. You said you use coffee grounds.
Yes. That, I think, is another surprising one for folks. They might not think those are edible, but I make a French press pot every morning. So I have a lot of coffee grounds, and I do have a garden, so they get put to good use there. But still, that's a lot of coffee grounds to go through. So in the cookbook, I'm using them in a nut butter. So they add texture and they add coffee flavor to that nut butter. But I also have another recipe on Food 52 for them that I love. It's a French silk pie, and the coffee grounds get used two ways. They get used in a crust along with the chocolate cookies.
So you're taking, like, the Oreo wafers.
Yes.
Which are becoming harder and harder to find.
Mm-hmm.
And you're whizzing those up with?
Used coffee grounds.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a great idea.
So that's making your crust, and then chocolate French silk filling. And then the coffee grounds are also used to infuse cream to make a whipped cream topping that has that same coffee flavor in it.
I love this because when we think of the word frugal or frugality, it seems punitive.
Yeah, and as does the word scraps. I think we just need an entire rebranding here to make everyone realize how great these things are.
Well, thank you so much, Lindsay Jean. It's a wonderful manual and really a font of ideas.
Thank you so much.
That's writer Lindsay Jean Hard. In January, I spoke with her about cooking with scraps, also the title of her book. After the break, we close out our Best of show with an insider's look at Norwegian lunch traditions. Stick around.
Well,
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman, and we've been playing back some of our favorite segments from the past year. In Norway, a packed lunch is a point of national pride. It's called mudpakke. In January, I learned about it from a Norwegian native here at KCRW.
I'm Christian Bordahl, and I guess I'm interim managing producer for Press Play.
Christian isn't only known around KCRW as our resident Norwegian, but also for his lunch.
I was born in Oslo, Norway, and I came to the U.S. when I was 16. Growing up in Norway was actually kind of bucolic. I grew up in this little neighborhood with a lot of kids my age. At the end of the street, there was a pond that would freeze over in the winter, and we would go down there and play ice hockey. We'd push the snow out of the way and play ice hockey. There was a forest up above behind my grandparents' house where we would go and play because my grandparents lived right across the street from me. And I would walk to school in this little two-room schoolhouse that was about a 10-minute walk away across some farm fields. It was really lovely. We never went out, you know, for dinner, to restaurants, anything like that. We just ate at home. Except every now and again, I might go into the city with my grandmother, in which case we would stop and have what's called rundstykker, or smørbrød. And that's basically, you know, sandwiches. Smørbrød literally means buttered bread. And almost all sandwiches in Norway have butter on them. Whatever the other thing is that comes with it, there's butter underneath there. And, you know, the basic stuff that you eat as a kid, it's this brown cheese that I have a version of right here that I brought with me called ekte geitost, which means literally real goat cheese, which is kind of a misnomer because it's actually partly goat and partly cow's milk. There is leverpostei, which is liver paste, basically pate, poor man's pate. There's caviar, a sort of poor man's version of caviar, which is this creamed cod roe that you get in a tube. A lot of things come in tubes in Norway. That kind of stuff. Salami, things that go on sandwiches. And, you know, people eat a lot of open-faced sandwiches in Norway, particularly for lunch. So a typical lunch for me is based around open-faced sandwiches. So it might be the brown cheese, it might be the caviar or the liver paste. Often these days, I'll also have hummus. I love that to have avocado, you know, so I'm definitely branched out. And the funny thing is that Norwegians literally, I mean, we do open-faced sandwiches even when we put them in a lunchbox, right, or in a lunch pack. So we've developed these little pieces of paper, like wax-proof paper kind of thing, that you put in between the sandwiches so that it covers the, you know, the caviar or mackerel or whatever it is that you have on your lunch. It doesn't go all over the place that way. But I enjoy putting a little lunch together and spending some time doing that, and it, you know, sort of diffuses the craziness of the morning, because the morning, of course, we're preparing for Press Play. It's a very intense time. Finally, when we're done with the show, we can exhale a little bit and take a little time to have a nice lunch. You know, Norway, after the Second World War, was a very poor country. I mean, it was a poor country before the Second World War, but it was occupied by the Germans during the Second World War. It's a farming and fishing community. And it wasn't until the late 60s into the 70s that things started to change, because the Norwegians found oil in the North Sea. And I think there is a thick vein of frugality that runs through kind of the Norwegian psyche and the culture. The matpakke that we were sort of talking about, this idea of making your food from home and bringing it with you, I think that's something that's become a kind of cultural norm for many people. And I don't know if it's frugality anymore as much as people are just used to it. And this is what I like to have for lunch, is something that I make for myself at home and I bring it with me. And then it's easy. I can sit at my desk, or I can go somewhere and sit and eat it. It's pretty quick and painless. And then I just get back to work and finish the day, because the Norwegians don't think about work, I think, in quite the same way that Americans do. In America, work is very much sort of how you view yourself, you know, is very much through the prism of, like, this is what I do. And it's the first question everyone asks, you know, what do you do? In Norway, people, I think, much more view work as something they do and make money at, but the rest of their life is, if not as important, probably the more important part of their life. So very family-oriented. They spend a lot of time traveling. They have great benefits in terms of, you know, paid vacation time and that sort of thing. So I'm always seeing my Norwegian friends on Facebook that are in Croatia, or they're in Greece, or, you know, they're traveling all over the place all the time, because they can, and because they that's a sort of life focus for them.
You can see pictures of Christian's lunch on his Instagram, The Resident Norwegian.
The mudpucker is a matter of deep cultural pride. They're all very particular about what the rules are, although it's not that clear.
I was curious to learn more about mudpucker, so I spoke with Zaria Gorvet, who wrote an article about it for the BBC. Hi, Zaria.
Hi.
When did the tradition of mudpucker start and why?
So it emerged from quite a long tradition of free school meals in Norway, which began in the 19th century. By the early 20th century, these free school meals weren't seen as particularly healthy. And so in Norway, they invented the Oslo breakfast. So this was like an upgraded version of the free school meals that had already been provided for decades. And it was designed by a university professor using the best scientific knowledge available at the time. And it was supposed to be basically as nutritious and cheap as possible. So it consisted of two slices of wholemeal bread with a tiny bit of butter, some cheap salad items like some lettuce, goat's cheese, and a glass of cold milk. And so it was rolled out across Oslo in the early 1920s. When there was still quite a lot of poverty in Norway. And it became very famous by the 1930s. There were all kinds of claims, like it was reported to make children become 25% taller if they'd been having this Oslo breakfast every day than children who hadn't, which seems a bit dubious. But it was very famous, and it was eventually adopted across Europe, this scheme of providing free school meals with the Oslo formula. And then eventually it was dropped, but by then it had caught on, and Norwegian parents just began making the basic meal for their own children themselves. And so it evolved gradually into a packed lunch.
And is that what this word that we're both, I'm sure, massacring means, mudpakke? What does it mean?
Mudde is a food, and then pakke is package. So it's like food package. So it's the Norwegian packed lunch, which is renowned for being extremely disappointing.
I love this part of the story, that all over Norway, people wake up early to prepare themselves a lunch that is guaranteed to be utilitarian and nothing else. So what does it consist of these days?
There are very strict unwritten rules about how to make a mudpakke. So today it's kind of evolved into a type of humble open sandwich. It's basically a stack of three slices of wholemeal bread, usually the really boring kind that you get in supermarkets, the kind of sort of floppy, cardboardy kind. And then there's a meaty, cheesy or fishy filling on top of each of those slices. So some popular filling options include stale liver pate or cheese from a tube. Nothing particularly appealing. Another popular option is sweaty brown cheese. It sounds really disgusting, but this one's actually quite delicious. It's made from cream and goat's milk, and it has a really low melting point, so it's really sweet and it melts in the mouth. It made global headlines back in 2013 because a whole lorry load caught fire and burned for 5 days. That's how melty and flammable it is. Anyway, so I've been told that adding anything fancy like cured meats and fresh salad would be sacrilege. But Norwegians seem quite divided on this point. When I originally wrote about this, the article got a lot of comments from angry Norwegians saying, no, actually, those things are fine now. So who knows?
And also the colour palette, it's very beige and brown.
Yeah, that's right. If a mudpucker has been made correctly, it will be dry, it will be flavourless, and it will be predominantly beige. That's very important.
So your article also got into some really interesting parts surrounding mudpucker, this idea of doing something, doing a practice. It's almost like a Zen practice. So that particular thing, lunch, is now deleted from your mind. You know exactly what you're going to do every single day. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to leave your office, go stand in line for half of your lunch break and get something smelly and bring it back.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So Norway is a very productive country. By some measures, it's one of the most productive countries in the entire of Europe. The tradition of the mudpucker just kind of really streamlines the working day. So in Norway, employees are only given about 30 minutes to have their lunch. And the mudpucker, you know, is quite a simple solution for making sure that they have shorter lunch breaks, which allow for their shorter working hours. So in Norway, people typically only work around 38 hours per week, whereas in the UK, we work for about 42 to 43 hours per week. So the MacBook seems to be very beneficial in the sense that it's efficient, it's simple, you know, you arrive, you already have your lunch, you don't have to go in queue for hours. So it's a practical take on food. One of my interviewees said that perhaps the reason that the mudpucker tradition has been so enduring in Norway is it's partly because they have a real strong sense of equality in Norway. So if you go into school as a child and you have really fancy fillings in your mudpucker, then the teachers will redistribute those fillings among the children so that nobody has a better lunch than anyone else. So you can't tell clearly in a classroom by looking at their lunch, you know, there's no clear poverty divide. You can't tell whose parents are, you know, better at making lunches or who has more money. And that continues throughout the lives of people in Norway because it's the same at work as well. You could have a mudpuck if you're a construction worker or if you're a banker. It's the same lunch made to the same formula.
Every time it's the beginning of the year, actually throughout the year, I think so much about how I personally have decision fatigue. I get so overwhelmed and then I procrastinate and don't do anything and then have terrible anxiety. Does this lunch help people with that?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, it might sound like a bit of a stretch, but there is a lot of evidence now that each decision we make takes a toll on our mental reserves. And eventually, later in the day, we'll make worse and worse decisions. In Norway, they have the same lunch every day, and they also have the same, you know, ingredients in their lunch every single day. And they have it at the same time of day every day. So, yeah, the mudpucker is probably quite a good way of avoiding decision fatigue.
I've been speaking with London-based journalist Zarya Gorvet. Find a link to Zarya's piece on mudpucker on our website. Visit kcrw.com/goodfood. That is it for a best of show. Thank you so much for listening to Good Food this year. In case you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, leave us a review to let other people find the show. My thanks to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Chuck Previtary, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Jacqueline Kim, Laura Kondarajan, and Amy Ta. I'm Evan Kleiman. We'll be back in the new year with more Good Food.